welcome to Presenting Alfred Hitchcock Presents, presented by the Ann Arbor District Library. I'm Al Sheridsma. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines crackpot as one given to eccentric or lunatic notions. This is not to be confused with crockpot, which Merriam-Webster says is used for an electric cooking pot. You would probably have to be a crackpot to mistake a crackpot for a crockpot, or perhaps mistake an alarm clock for a time bomb. That's about as far as I'm prepared to take that at the moment. So here's Hitch. He's in a very confined room with only a bench at the back for furniture, and he paces back and forth.
Good evening.
Good evening.
He reacts to that echo by looking up.
Good evening.
He motions to the camera to come closer, and it does.
Certain parties have been objecting to my candid remarks, so I'm doing tonight's show from this sealed chamber. It's as quiet as a tomb, which is not surprising, since it was the only type of structure available that suited our...
Certain parties have been objecting to my candid remarks, so I am doing tonight's show from this sealed chamber. Which is not surprising.
Are you quite finished? Here in a moment is tonight's play. It is entitled Crackpot.
Are you quite finished?
He puts his hands in his pockets and sits on the bench. So here's Crackpot. First broadcast on January 6th, 1957, starring Biff McGuire, Robert Emhart, and Mary Scott. Teleplay by Martin Berkeley, based on a story by Harold Gast, and directed by John Meredith Lucas. Only the writers are new to us, and of the rest, only Biff McGuire has not yet appeared in Season 2. This is his third of four appearances, his last two being Episode 31, The Gentleman from America, and Episode 34, The Hidden Thing. His next and last is Don't Interrupt, Episode 2 of Season 4. This is the third of six Alfred Hitchcock Presents and one Alfred Hitchcock Hour appearances for Robert Emhart after Don't Come Back Alive and De Mortuis.
De Mortuis.
De Mortuis.
De Mortuis.
His next is Martha Mason Movie Star, episode 34 of season 2. And this is the second of four Alfred Hitchcock Presents and four Alfred Hitchcock Hour appearances for Mary Scott after Mr. Blanchard's Secret, just a couple of episodes ago. Her next is The Diplomatic Corpse, episode 10 of season 3. And this is the second of three directing jobs for John Meredith Lucas, after Jonathan, episode 10 of season 2. His next and last is Malice Domestic, episode 20 of season 2. So in season 2, he directs episode 10, episode 15, and episode 20, and then he's gone from the scene. While he's here, he gives us some nifty little camera angles and close-ups, such as the opening of this episode, which begins with a close-up of a shoe lying in the road. It is tied with a string to a can, and the camera follows along to show the can is tied to a bucket, and then to another shoe, and then another bucket, and then another shoe, all the way up to the back of a car, where we see a jack has hoisted the back of it. We then move up the back of the car, past the California license plate, to Just Married, written on the trunk. Already we know, with no one saying a word, that our characters are newlyweds and they have a flat tire. But that's not the end of our opening continuous shot. Along with the visual, we've had the sound of tinkering as Mary Scott enters the frame. She is Meg Loomis, and the camera follows her to where her husband, Ray, played by Biff McGuire, is changing a tire. The camera stoops as she stoops to kiss him, and then stands back up as she stands again.
Oh, what about that, huh?
What about what?
You get a honeymoon once in your life, and I have to get a flat tire.
Do you mean me, darling?
Now, I'm almost through here.
You know, they say you learn a lot about people watching them under pressure. I've had a wonderful day learning about you.
Yeah, what did you learn about me that you didn't already know?
That you're very sweet.
Yeah, but you should have learned something else, too.
Oh, what?
That I love you very much.
This bit of dialogue isn't even necessary. We already knew that they were newlyweds and they had a flat tire. Meg says you learn a lot about a person under pressure, and they're going to undergo a lot of pressure before we're through. But she won't learn the most important thing about Ray until the very end. We're still in that opening continuous shot as the camera follows Ray after fixing the flat as he opens the trunk and lets the jack down.
Ray, are you sure this is the right road? I think we're lost.
Yeah, I guess I should have gone the way we'd go every summer. The way we used to go every summer with them.
It is only here, as Ray falters with his sentence, that we end our continuous shot and cut to a new one, which is a shot of Meg, even though Ray is the one who's talking. It is perhaps this, and that Meg was the first person we saw in this episode, that gives us a hint that she may actually be our main character. She is the one with whom we'll identify and sympathize when we get to the end. The use of the camera is one of the things I like about this episode. Another is the way the exposition gets parceled out to us bit by bit along the way.
Maybe it was too soon. Maybe we should have waited.
No. I'm sure it's what Aunt Florence would have wanted. She never did approve of mourning. Besides, I couldn't bear being without you any longer.
I couldn't bear it either. I only meant how it might look to other people, because of all the publicity.
So for now, we know that Meg and Ray married quickly after the death of his Aunt Florence, a death that was apparently out of the ordinary since it seems to have generated publicity. And maybe we don't even know that if we've been distracted by the partial billboard that is in the shot every time we focus on Meg, on which you can read Aus Fund, Blick Service. So that Blick pretty much looks like public, but what's that Aus? And, oh, wait a minute, were they saying something? I can't swear that the point of the billboard is to distract. Sometimes a billboard is only a billboard. But the main goal of the third character when he arrives is to distract Ray into revealing his secret. So why wouldn't the director distract the audience as well? Let's get back to our newlyweds in another intimate moment.
Let's start our honeymoon.
They kiss, with Ray being very sure to keep his greasy hands from touching her. Although he does put his greasy hands a little later on the back of his pants, to no apparent effect.
But let's start it in Santa Barbara.
Oh. Hey!
The camera follows Ray's gaze down to the tire that he has just put on, and it too is flat. Ray kneels down, joining the shot. And then we cut to a mid-shot of Ray, the tire, and Meg. It's essentially the shot we had at the beginning of the episode. So here we are then, back to square one.
I told that kid at the garage to check my spare. Wait a minute, he did check it, didn't he?
He was the one that told us about this shortcut.
So the kid at the garage checked their tires, only two of them are now flat, and he told them about the shortcut. I wonder what that's all about.
Well, I guess there's nothing else to do except to walk to the nearest station. It can't be too far from the main road. I just hate having to leave you here.
And why does he have to leave her there? Isn't it safer for them to stick together? Hasn't he read those stories where something bad happens to the person who stays behind? Doesn't he remember being in the hidden thing where Laura got killed just crossing the street by herself? Well, this is just another distraction, and he doesn't have to worry about any of those things. Because...
Hey, here comes the car.
Heading in the opposite direction. We get a low-angle shot as Ray kneels and kowtows to the approaching driver. And we switch to a long shot as the car drives in and out of the shot. But we hear the sound of its brake squealing, and it backs up again. So that we have a brief shot of both cars, the man driving the car, Meg and Ray, plus two things that weren't that noticeable before. The hubcap from the tire in question, and the tire itself, which Ray took off when he put on the spare. This latter is significant because I think it's this tire on which Ray trips, though they don't make a big deal of it. After that long shot, the camera moves inside the car as if sitting in the passenger seat, pointing towards the driver in profile as Meg and Ray look in at the driver's window. A nice shot. Our new arrival is dressed all in white, including the hat on his head, which certainly seems like a recipe for disaster. Ray asks for a ride to the nearest station, but the man has a better idea. He gets out of his car and opens his trunk.
I got this watch of McCall about a year ago. Works like a charm.
The whatchamacallit is a long tube, and he removes it and a blanket from the trunk, setting the blanket down by the flat tire so he can kneel and not stain his white pants.
I attach this end to my spare here. And I take the other end. Excuse me. And put it onto your tire here. Well, the pressures balance out. See? And my spare goes down, and your tire goes up. Well, not all the way, of course, but enough to get you to the station. And newlyweds are always in a hurry. Excuse me, ma'am. And nothing on earth as exciting as being newly married.
Oh, wait, we get a close-up of the man, and I can see the billboard behind him. It says Red Cross Fund.
Well, I guess you're all set to go now.
Yeah, I want to thank you very much for everything, Mr.
Moon. Oh, that's all right. Glad to help. Just hand me that end there.
Oh, look. Red Cross Fund. Something company as a public service. What did he say? Did he say his name was Moon? I wasn't paying attention. Well, even if you didn't get his name, I'm sure you recognized his voice. He's played by Robert Emhart. So, Ray takes the whatchamacallit and prepares to return it to Mr. Moon, but he trips over something, presumably that tire on the ground. And in breaking his fall, his greasy hands form greasy handprints right on Mr. Moon's white suit. The camera stays with this shot as we watch Moon's face go from affable to ugly.
I'm awfully sorry. That was awfully clumsy of me.
You stupid fool.
I'm very sorry.
Sorry?
Look, I know that, but let me take care of the damage, will you? I know a cleaner could get that thing out.
You think you could pay for what you did to me?
He uses the whatchamacallit as a whip, and the camera shifts to show us Ray and Meg recoiling back against their car. Then it's back to Moon again.
Look, I said I was sorry.
I could kill you for what you did.
Look, I said I was sorry. I said I could settle this thing up with you.
I could kill you.
He gets a scheming look on his face. Then he jumps into his car and drives off. We don't see the car go, but we hear it.
He's insane. He's completely insane.
Let's get out of here. Please.
Yeah, sure.
And so we dissolve to the close-up of a sign reading Welcome California Veterinary Association. The camera pans over and finds Ray pacing about in the midst of a very crowded hotel lobby, filled with extras whose names we never learn.
Darling, I'm sorry. I didn't know about the convention when I wired for the room. I guess I should have used Aunt Florence's name. They don't seem to recognize mine.
Not that it should matter whether they recognize his name or not if he's got a reservation. But it is a subtle indication that he has been very dependent on Aunt Florence. A bellboy comes up to them and places himself very nicely in between them for the camera shot.
Would you mind stepping into the manager's office, please?
Ray once again tries to leave Meg behind.
Sorry, you want to wait here?
No, I'll come to you.
Right this way, sir.
At the manager's office, they find a man sitting on the edge of the desk talking on the telephone. We don't see him full on until he pulls out his badge.
Good afternoon, Mrs. Loomis.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Loomis?
Look, I wired you a good week ago for that suite. We're here at our honeymoon.
I know. I'm not the hotel manager. Sergeant Carpenter.
Detective? Oh, not more questions.
Well, not really more questions, Meg. More like more exposition.
We picked up a man in Ventura last night. His description fits the one you gave us of your aunt's murderer. He had this bracelet with him. We thought it might be hers.
Yes. Yes, that is it, isn't it, Ray?
Are you sure, Mrs. Loomis?
Well, I've only seen it a few times, but no, I'm not sure.
It's not a bracelet I'd be inclined to forget.
Well, that sort of jewelry's worn to parties, Sergeant. I was her secretary. We never met socially.
Now, this isn't it. My aunt's bracelet had 15 emerald-cut diamonds in it. No. This isn't it.
Well, it was just a chance. We'll keep trying.
So let's see. We now know that Aunt Florence was murdered, that Meg was Ray's secretary, and that the murder perhaps took place during a robbery attempt, since a valuable bracelet, which Ray knows in detail, is gone. Let's pause for a moment and look at the man who plays Sergeant Carpenter. He is the reason that Michael J. Fox is Michael J. Fox, because he is Michael Fox. And he was already a member of the Screen Actors Guild when Michael J. Fox came along. Since the guild doesn't allow two people with the same name, Michael J. Fox had to use his middle initial. Although, actually, he didn't. His middle initial is A. And according to Wikipedia, he inserted the J into his name as a tribute to actor Michael J. Pollard. Michael Fox wasn't originally Michael Fox either. He was born Myron Melvin Fox. This is from his mini-biography on IMDb. Michael Fox first trod the boards in grade school plays in his hometown of Yonkers, New York. After toying with the idea of becoming a history teacher, Fox did, quote, something as foreign to my nature as one could think of, unquote, becoming a boomer, a migratory railroad worker, and taking jobs as a brakeman with various lines. His interest in acting was rekindled in the mid-40s, and he appeared in several little theater plays in Los Angeles. An acting-directing stint in a Players Ring production of Home of the Brave caught the eye of Harry Sauber, an associate of exploitation mogul Jungle Sam Katzman, who was the producer of the Superman and Batman movie serials, Earth vs. the Flying Saucers, and the Jungle Jim series, hence his nickname. So Michael landed his first film role in the Katzman-produced A Yank in Indochina. Other film credits include The Magnetic Monster, Machine Gun Kelly, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, The Dunwich Horror, The Longest Yard, and Young Frankenstein. His television credits include The Adventures of Superman, Columbo, The Mod Squad, Captain Nice, Lost in Space, Batman, and Seinfeld. He's in the Kolchak the Night Stalker episode, The Energy Eater, in 8 episodes of Science Fiction Theater, in the Kraft Suspense Theater episode, Kill No More, and in the 1980s Twilight Zone episode, A Message from Charity.
She'll be well enough, Obadiah, by and by. There's naught to be done but trust in the Lord, and heed Master Trowbridge's advice in the matter.
Master Trowbridge is more practiced at delivering lambs and foals than treating human maladies. Prescribing that foul concoction of pounded bayberry bark.
She's a strong girl, Obadiah. I have seen her at work with thee in the fields. She'll not succumb. Not charity.
But he's also in 3 episodes of the original Twilight Zone. He's one head of the two-headed Martian in Mr. Dingle the Strong.
Do you ever see such jerky-looking creatures? And one head yet. Typical Earthmen. Not really, though. The one in the middle, the one who just suffered the physical damage, he may be the very one we've been looking for.
How do you mean?
Silence. I'm receiving his waves.
He's the psychiatrist in Sounds and Silences.
Unless I'm very much mistaken, it is one of those very odd phenomena. Autosuggestion, we call it. A person talks himself into believing occurrences take place when indeed they are pure figments of imagination. Beyond that, Mr. Flemington, there is very definitely some suggestion here that you were very resentful of your mother and of her preoccupation with her imaginary aches and pains. And my guess, at least for the moment, would be that this particular feeling extended itself to your wife, who provided you with a similar mother image. But I can tell you this, Mr. Flemington, and forgive me if I repeat myself, these occurrences are pure figments of imagination.
And he's the doctor in Nightmare as a Child.
Is she going to be all right, Doc?
I've given her a sedative. Do you have everything you need, Lieutenant?
Yeah, I think so. It all ties in together.
She's a fortunate woman. She'd be a homicide victim if she were less fortunate.
What about that child she keeps talking about?
The child is her. At least she conjured up the child. It was a part of her buried deep inside. A memory, a recollection that finally had to come out. And when it did, it took the form of herself as a child.
All of which leads to the point that Michael Fox played a lot of doctors in his career, including in The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms.
This is Evans speaking. Who? Oh, yes, hello, Doctor.
Colonel, they've already brought in over 50 of your men and the people this afternoon. The monster's a giant germ carrier of a horrible, virulent disease. Contact with the animal's blood can be fatal. If you use shell fire, who knows how far the air will spread the particles of it?
The entire city can be endangered.
Right, Doctor.
And in 24 of his 25 appearances on Perry Mason, where he usually played the autopsy surgeon, Dr. Hoxie.
All right, Doctor.
I removed this bullet from the victim's brain. Death was virtually instantaneous. It was caused by a contact wound, which means the muzzle of the weapon was pressed against the body at the time the shot was fired.
And what other effect would this have, Doctor, beside the obvious one?
Well, a contact gunshot makes very little noise, rather like the sound you get when you blow up a paper bag and then explode it. Consequently, the sound of the gunshot might not even be heard.
With all that experience, Michael Fox was the perfect choice to play a doctor in the 1970 psychological experiment now known as the Dr. Fox Effect. It was conducted at the University of Southern California School of Medicine, and it dealt with lectures given to a classroom of MDs and PhDs on the meaningless topic mathematical game theory as applied to physician education. Michael Fox was given the identity Dr. Myron L. Fox, Myron, of course, actually being his real first name. USC law professor Deborah Jones Merritt wrote of it this way: "The experimenters created a meaningless lecture and coached the actor to deliver it with an excessive use of double talk, neologisms, non sequiturs, and contradictory statements. At the same time, the researchers encouraged the actor to adopt a lively demeanor, convey warmth toward his audience, and intersperse his nonsensical comments with humor. The actor fooled not just one, but three separate audiences of professional and graduate students. Despite the emptiness of his lecture, 55 psychiatrists, psychologists, educators, graduate students, and other professionals produced evaluations of Dr. Fox that were overwhelmingly positive. The disturbing feature of the Dr. Fox study, as the experimenters noted, is that Fox's nonverbal behaviors so completely masked a meaningless, jargon-filled, and confused presentation."
He's written in Science, for those of you who have subscribed to that magazine, that journal. And he also has, I think, two publications, two books on the topic that he's going to address us with today, and that is Behavioral Games as it Applies to Physician Learning. Dr. Myron Fox.
Thank you. There are several advantages I notice in coming from California. One is that you can wear shorts, whereas the Easterners wear a suit, and that you can wear a mock turtleneck shirt where we wear a tie. I'd like to start today by getting into the applicability of game theory in the field of medicine and in the field of teaching. Now, when von Neumann and Morgenstern started with game theory, it was not long before they realized that game theory was not primarily concerned with disclosing the optimum strategy. What it really is concentrating on is concerned with the logic of conflict, that is, with the theory of strategy. Now, In this way, interestingly enough, being here at the gambling state of Nevada, the question could be asked, does game theory differ from gambler's choice, where there is a conflict of interest between the two parties, out of which one is to emerge victorious and one is to be defeated? It is the application, if you will, of general systems where the entire man, the entire thing is discussed in relation to the ill of that patient, because everything changes.
In ping pong, which does not correspond to games of to game theory at all, I have won 3 games. And game theory doesn't help a hell of a lot there.
Chess. There have supposedly been a whole variety of differences. Chess does not come under this category because there are a whole series of potential changes which can occur in chess. Rappaport mentions in an article that many years ago, Capablanca, playing the great Cuban champion, played Marshall, the American champion, and Marshall, at the particular point of the crucial game, opened with a very alien, a very strange, a very foreign opening. And Capablanca, having a time in which he couldn't think about this, instead of folding up, which he said was his first reaction, and becoming panicky, instead thought for a moment and came back and accepted the challenge of Marshall and won, thus proving that he won because of a gamesmanship. He outplayed Marshall. He outplayed Marshall psychologically, as well as outplaying Marshall on the board. Now, to convince the other, we must get him to listen to us. And this cannot usually be done if we ourselves do not listen. We go in one door, we go all the way around, we come out the same way. I think the word was communication. We ourselves do not listen. Therefore, we must learn to listen in the broadest sense of listening, in the sense of assuming for a while the other's world outlook. Because only in this way will we make sense of what he is saying. All these skills are related not to know-how, but to wisdom. It may happen that if we acquire the necessary wisdom, many of the conflicts that the strategy experts in their professional zeal insist on formulating as battles of wits, or worse, as a battle of wills, will be resolved of their own accord. The applicability of these factors, the theory of games, to the field of not only psychiatry, but the teaching of psychiatry, the training, I think has great value. Thank you, gentlemen.
Mark Stanton sums it up in his blog on Duarte.com, writing, "Are we advocating that you be a charming charlatan in front of an audience to get notoriety? Of course not. It wouldn't surprise you that follow-up studies showed that people clearly learned nothing from these talks, despite being entertained by them. The point is, expertise only takes us so far. Being an engaging speaker helps the audience feel the weight of an idea. To the author of the study's point, a balanced combination of knowledge and personality are needed for effective teaching. This study highlights that being a thought leader takes more than just being super smart. Many of us spend many years in school and beyond gaining expertise, but to be truly recognized for it, we need to master the skill of communication." Beginning in 1989, Michael began appearing regularly in the soap opera The Bold and the Beautiful. He died in 1996 at the age of 75, and his death was written into the show. This is his only Alfred Hitchcock Presents appearance. The manager's phone rings while Ray and Meg are still with Sergeant Carpenter.
Yes? Well, fine, I'll tell him. That's the room clerk. He wants to see you at the desk.
So off they go.
Your room is ready now, Mr. Loomis. I'm sorry about the mistake. Your reservation was in order.
That's all right. I guess you do have your hands full with the convention.
Oh, others are not so considerate. I hope you enjoy your stay with us.
Thank you.
Luggage? Show Mr. and Mrs. Loomis to suite 308, please.
This way, please.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
The desk clerk is played by Raymond Guth. He was born in Oil City, Pennsylvania, and he studied acting at the Pasadena Playhouse while supporting himself working nights at a morgue. This is from the City Side with Gene Sherman column from the December 12, 1956 edition of the Los Angeles Times. Raymond Guth, the young actor who makes his television debut in the Alfred Hitchcock series on January 6th, couldn't have a more appropriate background. While attending classes at Pasadena Playhouse, Mr. Guth kept himself alive working the night shift in a mortuary. His principal job was answering telephones, which wasn't bad, except that for the first few nights, he was haunted by a ringing that seemingly had no source. A bell would ring, he'd pick up the phone, and it would be, you should pardon the expression, dead. My nerves were going, he recalls, until I discovered that next door to the mortuary was a nursery with an outside connection. Now, this episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents was his first credited television appearance, but in following years, he appeared in many television episodes of Wagon Train, The Virginian, Route 66, Daniel Boone, Rawhide, Perry Mason, Gunsmoke, Death Valley Days, Bonanza, Hazel, The Rookies, Happy Days, The Dukes of Hazzard, Little House on the Prairie, Heart to Heart, Moonlighting, and Highway to Heaven. Now, it may seem a bit surprising, considering how urbane his character is here, to see that in his later career he played a farmer 5 times, including in his Alfred Hitchcock Hour appearance. Even more surprising, he was a hobo in Bound for Glory and a giant tramp in Land of the Giants.
So, you want to play games, huh?
Chipper!
Harry!
Chipper, come back!
There you are.
Some of his other film appearances were in The New Centurions, The Bonnie Parker Story, Operation Bikini, The Reavers, Some Kind of Hero, and Silver Streak.
Hey, how you doing, old dude? What's happening?
Step away from the car.
I was listening to the engine. Sounds real good, man. Does it come with white walls?
Just move.
Okay, I'm gonna move now. You just take it easy, lower that rifle.
I said move.
Raymond Guth died in 2021 at the age of 97. This is his only Alfred Hitchcock Presents appearance, but as I said, he's in one episode of the Alfred Hitchcock Hour, Terror at Northfield, episode 3 of season 2. And so we dissolve to Suite 308 as the bellboy opens the door, followed by Ray and Meg, followed by a bellboy extra carrying all of the luggage. Don't feel too sorry for him, though. I suspect that all those bags he carried were empty.
Oh, it's really lovely.
Will there be anything else, sir?
No, that's all. Thank you. You'll take care of the other boy, would you?
Thank you, sir.
Right.
The bellboy who didn't carry the luggage and who gets some lines is the same bellboy who got lines a little earlier.
Would you mind stepping into the manager's office, please?
And he is Phil Garris. And what do I know about Phil Garris, beside the fact that his credits range from 1946 to 1979? Not a thing. In fact, his bio is so bare, this is what is listed in filmaclub.com. Phil Garris is an actor. Phil Garris has mostly worked in English and has worked in languages like English. Check out this page for more updates on Phil Garris. Of his credits, he appears in 2 Francis the Talking Mule movies, Francis Joins the Wax and Francis in the Navy. He's in the film Tangier. He's trumpet player Joe Becker in the Glenn Miller story.
Let's see.
Oh, no. Oh, you really split it open. You better have it looked at.
I'm sorry, Glenn.
Yeah, go on. Take care of it.
He's in Sex and the Single Girl, and he's supposed to be an engineer in the Heat of the Night, but I couldn't find him there. I did find him as a delivery boy in the My Favorite Martian episode, No Cure for the Common Martian.
O'Hara residence, matter of life and death?
What?
I got a delivery here for a Martin O'Hara. That'll be 482 COD.
Phil Garris died in 2004 at the age of 85. This is his only Alfred Hitchcock Presents appearance. After the bellboys leave, the camera shifts to outside the room on the other side of the balcony pointing in towards Meg, who is looking out at the sea, and Ray, who is coming to join her. The camera moves in as Ray approaches, giving us a classic, almost stereotypical shot of the two lovers gazing out in each other's arms. We also get a little bit more exposition.
You know, I wanted to carry you over the threshold, but I was afraid the bellboys wouldn't have understood.
They might not have approved. They'd have understood. Oh, the air smells so fresh and so clean.
Meg. Meg, I hope you're as happy as I am.
I am dying. If there's only one thing that can make me any happier, that's if we had our own place. Mm-hmm. You still don't want to go back to the house?
No, I want to sell it. We can build a new house, get an apartment, or maybe just travel.
Darn. People have died in hotels, too.
No, it isn't just that. I've spent too much time in that house. I hate it.
I guess that's just the difference in the way we were brought up. All my life, I've dreamed of having an estate like that. My folks didn't have much money.
Now, listen, when we got married, we said we were going to forget about the past. Let's just think about the future, huh? You know what I'm going to do?
No.
I'm going to carry you over the threshold like I planned.
You're going to snap this honeymoon off right.
Well, that romantic music sure turns suspenseful in a hurry, and that's because when Ray opens the door, he finds Mr. Moon standing on the other side. There is a moment as Ray carries Meg when he seems to trip a little bit, and this seems real and accidental to me. But on the other hand, the last time Ray tripped, he ended up in Mr. Moon's lap, so to speak, and here he does it again. The last time we saw Moon, he was angelic in that white suit, contrasted by the ugly expression on his face. Now he's in a dark suit, but he appears cheerful and affable again, which is a good thing, because with Meg in his arms, Ray is in no position to defend himself.
What do you want?
308. Oh, I beg your pardon. This is the wrong room. I'm next door in 306.
Next door?
He holds up the white suit, which has been cleaned.
The valet did a rush job and a very excellent one. May I recommend him if you have any cleaning, ma'am? See? Not a spot.
Well, I'm glad. I only wish you'd let me pay for the cleaning.
Oh, it was an accident. See you later, ma'am.
Oh, no, that's a switch. Well, he's a real crackpot.
And speaking of crackpots and switches, the episode is about to try to change our perspective on who we think the titular crackpot is. And further speaking of switches, wasn't Mr. Moon traveling in the other direction? What is he doing in this hotel? Anyway, Ray never does carry Meg across the threshold, which may be just as well. She goes to the bedroom to unpack, and the camera joins her.
Hey, Meg, you know...
Hmm?
I think I've seen him somewhere before.
That is strange, darling. You don't see many good Samaritans floating around these days.
I just can't think where.
Well, if he's here for the convention, maybe he's a vet or something that you took the dog to.
Couldn't be that. I never had a dog.
Oh. Do you know, this was a lovely gift, darling. It's the first luggage I've ever owned. I always had to use my mother's or my sister's overnight case.
So Ray now thinks Mr. Moon looks familiar. And Meg tells us that her luggage was a gift, presumably from Ray. I wonder if he bought it before or after the murder. Meg tells Ray,
I think I'll go and get cleaned up.
So Ray returns to the living room. The camera joins him. It pans along with him as he steps out toward the balcony to light a cigarette.
Come in.
Then follows him to the front door, as he opens it and finds no one there. Closing it again, he locks it. So Ray never carries Meg across the threshold, and he never lights that cigarette. as it becomes clear that the knocking is not coming from the door, but the wall, we get a close-up of a picture on that wall shaking. Ray stands on the couch there and pounds on the wall back.
Hey, stop it, will ya? Stop it, huh?
Hello? What? That's right, sir. Mr. Moon in 306 complained you were pounding on his wall.
I was just trying to get him to stop. Well, no, he's not hammering now. Well, I should hope so.
This is a strange little sequence. First of all, there's no time between the stopping of the knocking and the ringing of the phone for Mr. Moon to call the front desk and complain. And second, if Ray is repeating the desk clerk's words, how does he know that the sound from 306 is hammering? Why, you would almost think that there's some kind of conspiracy going on, unless it's all in Ray's imagination, since the hammering picks up again once Ray puts down the phone. Maybe Ray is the crackpot of our title after all. On the other hand, it could just be that the walls in this hotel are paper thin, and Mr. Moon can hear everything that's being said. Of course, Ray didn't hear Mr. Moon's call to the desk clerk, but maybe that call didn't take place after all. The sound of the hammering has changed. Now it sounds like someone pounding on a chisel. Ray has had enough. He goes out onto the balcony, and it turns out the balcony goes all the way around, so Ray is able to walk right over and peer into Mr. Moon's room. This is not particularly safe if you're worried about a crackpot, but it does allow Ray to push Moon's balcony door open just a bit and peer inside, where he sees Moon making a big hole in his wall with his hammer and chisel. We just get a glimpse, but we can see that he has taken the mirror down and that he has an alarm clock and what look like two big batteries on a table nearby, as if he's building a bomb. Moon seems to sense Ray right away, and he turns to look. Ray backs off, quickly, as if repelled, and the camera follows him back along the balcony and then stays on the balcony as he walks across his room and leaves out the front door. It's a nice shot. Now we join Ray out in the hall as he walks over to room 306 and pounds on the door. Mr. Moon quickly answers.
Oh, it's you. Sorry to have complained, but I've had a very long drive. I've been trying to take a nap.
Take a nap? You've been hammering on the wall. What is it you want? What are you trying to do?
Trying to do?
I saw you knocking a hole in that wall.
A hole in... Are you out of your mind?
I saw it.
Ray forces his way in. If there's a hole in the wall, the mirror now covers it. So maybe he is out of his mind. All he has to do is remove that mirror and see if there's a hole there. But he never gets the chance. Even as we see Ray in the mirror, a hand comes up behind him. And that hand is holding a gun.
I have a permit to carry this gun. Man has a right to protect himself. Now get out of here and don't come back.
Yes, but I saw...
Young man, you need a psychiatrist. Now, any more trouble, I'll call the police and have you put away.
And we're back out in the hall again as Ray starts to wonder which of the two of them is the crackpot. Leading us to commercial. When we return, Ray enters his room, looking as stunned as he did when we left him. Meg comes out of the bedroom and joins him. She is dressed in what looks like a granny nightgown. Not exactly what you'd expect for a honeymoon, but considering the way things turn out, it might be just as well. Ray lays the whole story out, but he adds a little something that we haven't heard before.
He's got a gun.
Who's got a gun?
Mr. Moon. Remember he said he was going to kill me? I was right about him, Meg. We've got to get out of here.
Darling, I don't know what you're talking about.
He pulled a gun on me when I found out why he was hammering on the wall.
Hammering on the wall?
Yes. Remember I said I thought I saw him somewhere before? Well, it was on the night of my aunt's death.
Do you mean that he's the...
Yes, that's why he wants to kill me. Now, do you understand? Because I can identify him.
Did he find out why he was hammering on the wall? Maybe he saw that alarm clock and those batteries and figured that, well, what he figures later on. But he's also now figured, or so he tells Meg, that Mr. Moon is his aunt's murderer. But by the time we get to the end of this episode, we'll know that that's not true. And we'll know that Ray knows it's not true. So why does he tell this to Meg? Perhaps he has recognized Mr. Moon, and he wants to prod her into a swift departure. As for whether Mr. Moon wants to kill Ray, well, Meg has a practical response.
Oh, darling, if he wanted to kill you, he could have done it back in the road when there was no one around. Now, wait until we get into a crowded hotel.
Yes, but I was just in his room. He pulled a gun on me. He's knocked a hole through the wall.
Ray takes down the picture above the couch. There is no hole in the wall.
I don't see a hole.
Well, it's almost through the wall.
But why?
Well, I don't know why. Maybe he wants to spy on me. Maybe he wants to shoot me. Yes, of course, this way he could shoot me and he wouldn't even have to enter the room.
But it wouldn't work, darling. They'd find the hole in the room where he was registered.
Plus, there'd be a bullet hole in the painting, and good luck firing blind through that painting and hitting Ray.
I don't know. Maybe I'm all wrong about Mr. Moon. Maybe I never did see him before. He could be just a crackpot, but somehow I feel it's dangerous for us to stay here.
Ray, darling, maybe you'd feel better if we moved to another suite.
It's fun to see Mary Scott as the voice of reason, two episodes after seeing her as Babs Fenton with the overactive imagination. So Ray calls the front desk and requests a different room and is told that there's none available because of the convention. And Meg talks him down, telling him they should order some champagne and toast Mr. Moon. She goes back in the bedroom. Something about having some dresses she's steaming in the bathroom?
I've been steaming some dresses in the bathroom.
Yeah, I think that's what she says. Anyway, she exits, and as soon as she's gone, Ray hears a ticking sound. This leads us to a shot that bothers me, because it's a shot intended to fool us and not Ray. We are back in Mr. Moon's room, where he has put an alarm clock into the hole in the wall. But there are wires coming down from the alarm clock that look like they're attached to those batteries we saw before. So this seems to be telling us that Mr. Moon has concocted a bomb. It's not telling that to Ray. Ray is never going to see this. It's for our eyes only, and since we later learn that Mr. Moon has not concocted a bomb, it's a bit of a cheat. It also has the unfortunate side effect of showing us that Ray is not imagining this. While we're still with Moon, he hears Meg coming, and he pulls the clock out and hides it under his coat, muffling the sound.
I don't hear anything.
This game gets played once again as Meg goes to the phone to order champagne, and Ray hears the ticking again. But by the time he calls her over, the ticking has stopped. This reminds me of William Shatner calling the flight attendant over to try to see the little man on the wing in the Twilight Zone episode Nightmare at 20,000 Feet.
Here, quickly! There's a man out there.
What?
Look, he's crawling on... Must have been the
bomb. What is it?
Oh, it's nothing, Mrs. Wilson. Can I get you anything?
A glass of water.
Surely.
But the game doesn't go on for long. Ray tells her not to treat him like a fool. She tells him she doesn't want to fight on their honeymoon.
I've loved you from the first moment I ever saw you. I always wanted to marry you. Dreamed of this for a long, long time. I don't want anything to spoil it.
And they kiss and make up, whereupon they both hear the ticking sound. And Ray decides...
It's a bomb.
What?
Sure, the hole in the wall, the wiring, the clock, it's a time bomb.
You don't really think that's possible?
Yes, I'm sure it is. We've got to get out of here.
But surely he wouldn't blow himself up, just...
Quite right, ma'am. I have no intention of being blown up.
Mr. Moon has opened their door, and he has his gun in his hand. Maybe Ray should have locked that door again.
I have exactly 3 minutes. Time enough to get comfortably down the back stairs and out of the building.
But why? Why should you want to kill us?
Why did he tell you, ma'am?
Because you killed my aunt.
No, why did I do that, Mr. Loomis?
There's a nice shot here from behind Moon, with Meg and Ray confronting him, and the seaport behind.
She caught you at the safe, you got panicky, and you hit her.
That's an accurate description of the murder. He's answered your questions, Mrs. Loomis.
But my husband wasn't able to identify you. He's been days going through the police files. You're safe. Please let us go.
No sense arguing with him, Meg. He's insane.
Don't say that.
So we're back to Mr. Moon being the crackpot. Or at least he gets very cranky when his sanity is questioned. But I'm more interested in a couple other things he says.
That's an accurate description of the murder.
And...
No, why did I do that, Mr. Loomis?
So Moon has a working knowledge of Aunt Florence's murder. He also knows Ray's last name, although Ray has never told him. Now, if he was the actual killer, then he would know these things. But he's not. And Ray knows he's not. So this may fool Meg, but it shouldn't fool Ray. Ray should catch on right away that this guy must be with the police. He doesn't.
Don't make me shoot you. Well, it's time to go now. I'll just take the precaution of locking the door.
Now, we've seen earlier that these doors require a key, so there's no guarantee that Ray has left the key in the door. But it doesn't really matter to Mr. Moon, because he's not really planning to lock that door. Instead, he's setting himself up so that Ray can punch him in the stomach and give him a karate chop on the neck, apparently knocking him flat to the floor. Meg wants to get out right away, but Ray sends her on her way because he has something he needs to do first. He steps over Mr. Moon's body and goes into the bedroom, where he finds Meg's vanity case, which he closes up and lifts up. But Mr. Moon interrupts him. He's not unconscious. He's not on the floor. Instead, in another nice shot, we see him in the mirror as he enters the room, gun drawn.
Well, very clever. I'll take that case.
He brings it to a bench at the foot of the bed, opens it up, and dumps the contents out on the bed, holding Ray off with his gun.
Oh, he searched all the luggage, but...
He gets an idea and uses his gun to shatter the mirror that's in the lid of the case, leading to another nice shot of Moon reflected in the shattered mirror as he pulls a necklace very similar to the one Sergeant Carpenter showed us out from behind. Ray starts to bargain with him. He still hasn't figured out who this guy is.
Mr. Moon, if you want the jewelry, take it.
But let me out of here before that bomb goes off.
But then Meg and Sergeant Carpenter quickly arrive.
Ray, let's get out of here.
Take it easy, ma'am.
Who are you?
Detective, Pasadena Police.
What does he mean, Ray?
Your husband was in debt, Mrs. Loomis. Meant to commit burglary, ended with murder.
Sorry to involve you in this, ma'am. It's the only thing I could think of to trap him. That's pretty stupid. Could have ruined the whole plan. Forgot to shut off the alarm.
The final shot is of Meg, a tear going down her cheek, looking up at Ray, reminiscent of the reaction shot that Mary Scott has at the end of Mr. Blanchard's Secret. Let's look at our writers. Harold Gast is credited with the story. This is from his Los Angeles Times obituary. Born in New York City, Gast graduated from the University of Michigan with a degree in speech. During World War II, he served in the U.S. Army Signal Corps. He started his writing career in the 1950s for such New York-based radio shows as Front Page Feral and Real Stories from Real Life. Turning his attention to television, he became a prominent writer of such New York-based shows as Armstrong Circle Theater, U.S. Steel Hour, and The Defenders. Relocating to Los Angeles in the mid-1960s, Gast wrote for such popular series as Dr. Kildare, Ben Casey, and I Spy. His list of writing credits includes a number of crime and legal shows, including Judd for the Defense, which he later produced, and Cannon, which he also produced. Also on the list are shows including The Untouchables and The Felony Squad. He wrote and produced several miniseries, including Guilty or Innocent, The Sam Shepard Murder Case, The Jesse Owens Story, From Here to Eternity, and A Woman Called Golda, which starred Ingrid Bergman and won an Emmy Award in 1982. In addition to that, he produced the short-lived Rod Serling series The New People, wrote two episodes of The Further Adventures of Ellery Queen, and wrote the episode End in Violence for the Alfred Hitchcock-produced series Suspicion. Now, I haven't been able to find the actual story, but Crackpot was previously produced in 1954 on the series The Web, so it's possible that Harold Gast didn't write a story at all, but a previous teleplay. It wouldn't be the first time we'd seen that. Harold Gast died in 2003 at the age of 85. This is his only Alfred Hitchcock Presents credit. And if you want an autographed Harold Gast index card, you can find one on eBay for $7.99 plus shipping. All right, so it's possible that Harold Gast wrote a previous teleplay, but Harold Gast did not write this teleplay. This teleplay was written by Martin Berkeley. He was born in Brooklyn, and he had a couple of unsuccessful runs of plays on Broadway in the 1930s. But starting in 1940, he began working for MGM, and then in 1945 for 20th Century Fox. In 1949, he was nominated for the Writers Guild of America Award for Best Written American Western for his work on Green Grass of Wyoming. The Alfred Hitchcock Presents Companion says Martin Berkeley was a screenwriter at Universal when an offer to script an episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents came his way. Berkeley had already scripted the science fiction classics Revenge of the Creature and Tarantula, and was at the time scripting the movie The Deadly Mantis. But the main thing to know about Martin Berkeley is that he named names to the House Un-American Activities Committee. This is from Wikipedia. After being identified by another screenwriter, Richard Collins, Berkeley at first denied the charge that he belonged to the Communist Party, though in fact he had belonged to the party until 1943. Friends heard of the accusations against him and initiated a defense fund in his support. Then he admitted he had been a party member and agreed to cooperate with the committee's investigation. One study of the period says he gave up 155 names. Journalist Victor Nevasky estimated the number he implicated at 161 and wrote that many of his identifications were inaccurate. Among those Berkeley said attended a meeting of party members at his house was Lillian Hellman. Berkeley has been called HUAC's number one friendly witness because he provided more names and more thorough documentation than any other witness. He gave the committee so many names that a Hollywood joke said he was simply replicating the membership list of a club frequented by Hollywood celebrities. Others he named included Dorothy Parker and Dashiell Hammett. HUAC investigator William Wheeler reportedly told Berkeley that he was providing more names than they needed. Don't name that many. You're just going to get yourself in big, deep trouble. Berkeley testified publicly on September 19, 1951, and in closed meetings of the committee in 1953. He told the committee that people in his role could not work communist propaganda into scripts without it being noticed by film producers and studio executives. He painted a particularly negative portrait of writer John Howard Lawson, the first president of the Screenwriters Guild, as the grand poobah of the communist movement, who speaks with the voice of Stalin and the bells of the Kremlin. Following his testimony, Berkeley became a member of an organization formed to expose communist influence in the entertainment industry, the Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals. Martin Berkeley died in 1979 at the age of 74. This is his only Alfred Hitchcock Presents credit. And I wanted to mention Ellsworth Fredericks, who is the director of photography of this episode, his first of only two. He was born in the Bronx, and he started his career with the Joe McDoakes short, So You're Going to the Dentist. We encountered Joe McDoakes in a previous podcast. And then he did eight more Joe McDoakes shorts. He was the director of photography for With Six You Get Egg Roll, 7 Days in May, The Stripper, Friendly Persuasion, The Young Guns, World Without End, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, So Big, and four episodes of Suspicion. And he was nominated for an Academy Award in the category of Best Cinematography for the film Sayonara. Ellsworth Fredericks died in 1993 at the age of 89, and his next and last Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode is The Deadly, episode 11 of season 3. Now, why not another episode of
Ingrid, it's only a movie.
These are things that I come upon that don't fit smoothly into anything I plan to discuss. This time, let's take a visit to the Hitchcock Hotel, established in 1980. When I first looked this up a couple of years ago now, the website had a big welcome sign on it, and it featured old buildings with old brick walls and fireplaces, with movie posters on some walls of the rooms, and of course there was a picture of the shower. It advertised a single room as £55 a night with breakfast. Now, the website says, "Welcome to our boutique hotel in the making, on the edge of Epping Forest. 25 New York loft-style rooms. Check in at 2 p.m., check out at 11 a.m. Simple. Room info coming soon." Epping Forest is, says Wikipedia, a 59-acre area of ancient woodland and other established habitats which straddles the border between Greater London and Essex. And the black-and-white photo of the hotel, or more likely a model of the impending hotel, makes it look like an English country estate version of Rear Window. And so it's appropriate that the restaurant in residence at the Hitchcock Hotel is the Rear Window restaurant. A visionary team has taken over the Hitchcock Hotel to create a new and altogether different dining experience. Are you sitting comfortably? Taking reservations 2 weeks ahead for our winter a la carte menu for indoor and outdoor dining. And within the Rear Window restaurant is Alfred's bar. Care for a drink? Allow our notoriously gifted crew to take you on a journey. It'll be pure alchemy. Wild ideas, intoxicating atmosphere, a kaleidoscope of flavor profiles, and frankly, the best wine cellar on these islands. Every glass tells a story. And then, for coffee and dogs, there's the Pleasure Garden. Coffee first, dog walk later. Only one is a wanderer. Two together are always going somewhere. Madeline from Vertigo, named greatest film of all time. Open every day, 11:30 a.m. to last orders. So that is the Hitchcock Hotel as it stands right now, or at least as the website stands right now. How about we look in again sometime in the future and see how it all transpires? All right. We've watched enough of these episodes to know that if an aunt is murdered or threatened with murder, that the culprit is always the nephew. The writers and director know this too, so that the way they try to thwart our expectations is to hold off on the exposition so that by the time we learn that Aunt Florence has actually been murdered, we've already been introduced to Mr. Moon, whose moment of insanity makes Ray look normal by comparison. The nice camera shots and things like the Red Cross billboard serve to distract us, too. Add to that the fact that we see most of the events from Ray's point of view, so that we assume he's the protagonist, although maybe he isn't, and factor in Robert Emhart's wonderful Jekyll Hyde performance. And this episode successfully keeps you guessing until the very end. But does it hold up once you learn the solution? Let's look at Ray first, now that we know he's the murderer. After killing Aunt Florence and stealing her jewelry, he marries his secretary, who has been in love with him since she first saw him, buying her a set of luggage for a wedding gift into which he can hide the jewels. So does Ray really love Meg? We never know for sure. He and Meg then go on their honeymoon to a hotel previously patronized by Aunt Florence, which seems like a bad idea, and they apparently notify the police where they will be so that Sergeant Carpenter can come and show them a bracelet that fools Meg, but not Ray. Which begs the question, how many nephews are intimately familiar with their aunt's jewelry so that they can tell the difference between the actual and an inspired fake? My guess is not many. And I think Ray would have better served himself to say, "Well, that might be it. I can't be sure. Rather than helping to confirm what the police already believe, that he knows the difference because he has the original in his possession. When Mr. Moon re-enters the scene and convinces Ray that he's building a bomb, Ray first tells Meg that he's seen Mr. Moon before. Now, is he just making this up, or has Moon been tailing them for a while? Regardless, he then ends up telling Meg that Moon is his aunt's killer, which he knows is not true because, of course, he is his aunt's killer. It makes sense when he is trying to convince Meg to leave the hotel, but it doesn't make sense when Moon confronts them and knows details of the crime.
That's an accurate description of the murder.
That he shouldn't know, unless he is the murderer or the police. And yet the bomb bluff still works on Ray. And even when Moon finds the jewels, it doesn't occur to Ray that he's the police. All right, to be fair, maybe the details of the crime are in the newspaper, and Moon has got him so rattled that he doubts his own sanity. So let's put Ray aside and take a look at the police. We now know that Moon is a Pasadena detective who suspects Ray Loomis of robbing and murdering his aunt, but who needs the stolen jewelry to prove it. And so he concocts an elaborate scheme, enlisting, I presume, Sergeant Carpenter, the desk clerk, and maybe even the bellboy. And what is the scheme? To convince Ray he's a bomb-making crackpot, scaring Ray into revealing the location of the jewels in his haste to escape. But it's more than that. He may possibly have arranged the double flat tires that Meg and Ray have.
I told that kid at the garage to check my spare. Wait a minute, he did check it, didn't he?
And he was the one that told us about the shortcut.
So maybe Moon not only got together with the desk clerk and the bellboy, but the kid at the garage, who flattened both tires and gave them the shortcut, allowing Moon to conveniently drive by and help out, although he strangely comes from the other direction, making it curious that he then shows up at the hotel. In any event, Moon arrives conveniently with the whatchamacallit tube and puts air in their tire, and then he seems ready to go, very affably, until Ray trips and puts greasy handprints on his white suit. Now, one thing that we haven't considered is that Moon may be the police, but he may also be a crackpot. After all, he seems to get very disturbed later on when Ray calls him insane.
No sense arguing with him, Meg. He's insane.
Don't say that.
But if the idea is just to make Ray believe he's a crackpot, then what was the plan here? He certainly couldn't count on Ray tripping or on Ray getting his greasy handprints on his nice suit. And if he had something else in mind, he better think fast, because he was getting ready to leave. So one way or the other, Moon has established himself as a crackpot. Now we come to the hotel, where the plan really picks up speed. I think we can assume that the police did not arrange for the veterinary convention, although it is nicely convenient, isn't it, in that it allows the desk clerk to tell Ray there's no other room to which he can move. So while that may not be planned, the stall on assigning them a room certainly is. This is presumably when, as Mr. Moon later tells us,
well, we searched all the luggage, but...
which probably involves the police, the desk clerk, and the bellboy. So now Ray and Meg meet with Sergeant Carpenter. I assume that this story...
We picked up a man in Ventura last night. His description fits the one you gave us of your aunt's murderer. He had this bracelet with him.
...is bogus, so that means they had a bracelet built that resembles Aunt Florence's bracelet, closely enough to fool Meg, specifically to trap Ray into revealing that he knows the difference? Apparently so. We have another convenient coincidence when Ray opens the front door, preparing to carry Meg across the threshold, and finds Mr. Moon right there, with his comment,
308! I beg your pardon, this is the wrong room. I'm next door in 306.
We can pretend that he had another plan in mind. This way, of course, is much more suspenseful. Now, when it comes to the hammering, clearly the desk clerk is in on this, because he tells Ray...
That's right, sir. Mr. Moon in 306 complained you were pounding on his wall.
Before Moon has any time to call and complain about this. But the desk clerk calls Ray, so how does he know when to call? As for the pounding, is it really necessary to chisel a big hole in the wall? The hotel is fine with this? How does Moon know that Ray's going to sneak a peek from the balcony? He covers the hole when Ray comes to the front door. Why does Moon go along with Ray's claim that he's his aunt's murderer when Moon suspects that Ray is the murderer? The only person he's fooling is Meg. Why, for that matter, set up a plan where he allows Ray to punch him in the gut and karate chop him on the neck? And, as dramatic as it is, why does Moon break the mirror in the vanity case when he could probably remove the jewels the same way Ray put them in? Well, I think I answered that one with the dramatic bit. Actually, drama is the point of all of it. But really, why go to the trouble of involving the hotel and the gas station, creating a phony bracelet, having one detective pretend he's a crackpot that knocks a hole in the wall as if he's planting a bomb, just to have your suspect reveal where the jewels are hidden when all you really have to do is get a search warrant for the luggage and have some professionals really take it apart? Except all of this may be beside the point, because Ray may not be our protagonist. It could be that Meg is our protagonist. So let's look at this from Meg's point of view. She is Ray Loomis's secretary, and she has loved him from the first time she saw him. She also has had dreams of living in a big house, like Ray and Florence did, because she comes from a family who has never been well off. So to her, this seems like a dream come true, but it's a dream that starts to crumble. We never get any details about Ray and Meg's courtship, so as far as we know, there was none. As I mentioned before, Ray may not even care for Meg. She just may be someone convenient, someone he knew loved him, that allows him to hide the jewels and get away. So if we look at the story from Meg's point of view, the flat tire, Mr. Moon, and the police interrupting their honeymoon are annoyances. What really disturbs her is the shaking up of her dream, learning that Ray is not interested in the big house.
I want to sell it. We can build a new house, get an apartment, or maybe just travel.
And when his fears collide with her common sense and lead to perhaps their first argument.
Let's not fight. I've loved you from the first moment I ever saw you. I always wanted to marry you. Dreamed of this for a long, long time. I don't want anything to spoil it.
When she finally buys into the bomb idea and flees the room, she doesn't abandon Ray. She comes back with Sergeant Carpenter, only to then have everything fall apart around her. So on one level, this is a mystery story. But on another level, this is a tragic story of dreams gone wrong. When you consider that Meg is the first person you see in the episode, expressing her fear, however frivolously, that she is the equivalent to Ray of a flat tire.
You get a honeymoon once in your life, and I have to get a flat tire.
Do you mean me, darling?
And when you consider that Meg is the last person you see in the episode, staring up at Ray, a tear running down her cheek, her fears realized, then I know what I think of the two story types is the more important. And now, here's Hitch with the alternate outro from the DVD.
We wanted to withhold the end of that story, but decided it was better that you learn the truth about Ray Loomis now than later.
Someone breaks a hole in the wall behind him.
I knew it. It's the ITA. It's futile to try to escape. We shall be back soon with another play. Don't you try to escape. Good night.
Now remember that these alternate versions were created for the European market, perhaps specifically for the British market. So I believe that the ITA, to which Hitch refers, is the Independent Television Authority, about which Wikipedia says, the ITA was an agency created by the Television Act of 1954 to supervise the creation of independent television, ITV, the first commercial television network in the United Kingdom. The ITA existed from 1954 until 1972. It was responsible for determining the location, constructing, building, and operating the transmission stations used by the ITV network, as well as determining the franchise areas and awarding the franchises for each regional commercial broadcaster. The authority began its operations on August 4, 1954. The ITA determined that the first three franchise areas would cover the London area, the English Midlands, and Northern England. All three franchise areas would be awarded on a divided weekday-weekend basis, and it was planned that the franchise holders for these areas would produce the great bulk of network programs, while the companies given the smaller franchises would produce mainly local programs for their area only. The original American outro says nothing about the ITA, but it does begin the same. So let's replay that part, and I will read the rest of it.
We wanted to withhold the end of that story, but decided it was better that you learn the truth about Ray Loomis now than later. I knew it.
It's the sponsor. The world just isn't big enough to escape. If some of you are contemplating leaving the room, don't. It's futile. No matter where you hide, he'll seek you out. You might just as well sit where you are until I return. Alfred Hitchcock Presents Season 2, Perry Mason, Season 2, Volume 2, The Twilight Zone, the complete first, second, and fifth seasons, The Glenn Miller Story, and Silver Streak are all available at the Ann Arbor District Library. The My Favorite Martian episode and the Dr. Fox Effect clip are both available online. If you would like to contact me about this podcast, please email me at sjoerdsmaa@aadl.org. That's sjoerdsmaa@aadl.org. And please put Hitchcock somewhere in the subject line. Next time, episode 55, Nightmare in 4D, starring Henry Jones and Barbara Baxley. That's all until our next program, which is just 1 week away as the crow flies. Good night.
Good night.